Welcome back, returning listeners, and a warm welcome to those tuning in for the first time. You've just stepped into the shadows of Dark Florida, where we uncover the eerie, the unexplained, and the downright chilling. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland, and I'm so glad you're here. But before we dive into today's mystery, I have some exciting news. On April 5th, I'll be speaking at the Great Florida Bigfoot Conference at the Skunk Ape Roundtable. If you're in the area, I'd love to meet you, hear your stories, and talk all things cryptid. It's going to be an incredible event, so make sure to mark your calendars. And speaking of stories, if you have had a strange encounter, a cryptid sighting, or anything unexplained that you'd like to share, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to me directly at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. Whether you want to be a guest on the show or just share your experience, my inbox is always open. Now, tonight's story takes us far from the swamps of Florida and deep into the snow-covered Ural Mountains, where in 1959, 9 experienced hikers met a gruesome and mysterious fate. What started as a routine trek ended in terror, with bodies found mangled, radioactive, and with missing eyes and tongues. Was it a tragic accident, a Soviet weapons test, or something even more sinister? Let's step into the cold and uncover the truth, if the truth is even meant to be found. Imagine this, a remote, snow-covered mountain in the Soviet wilderness, its name already an omen. Kolat Seyakol, aka the Mountain of Death. It was here, in the unforgiving cold of February 2nd, 1959, that something unexplainable happened. A group of 10 skilled hikers, students from Ural State Technical University, set out on what should have been a challenging but well-mapped expedition across the northern Ural Mountains, led by Igor Davolov. They were experienced, disciplined, and prepared. Yet, they never made it back. Days later, when the search teams finally discovered what remained of their journey, the scene was nothing short of chilling. Their tent, slashed open from the inside, stood abandoned, their tracks leading away into the darkness. Some were found frozen, half-dressed in the snow, as if they had fled in a blind, desperate panic. Others bore injuries so severe, crushed ribs, fractured skulls, that seemed almost impossible without the force of a brutal attack. Stranger still, some were missing eyes. One had no tongue. Theories were flying around. Was it an avalanche? Military experiments, infrasound-induced madness, or something far more sinister lurking in the mountains. Decades later, the mystery of what happened at Davolto Pass remains. In early 1959, a group of young adventurers set out on what was meant to be the journey of a lifetime, a ski expedition across the harsh, frozen terrain of the northern Urals in the Soviet Union. Led by 23-year-old Igor Davolov, a radio engineering student from Yuri Polytechnical Institute, he had no idea that his name would forever be tied to this tragic piece of history. The team was made up of 9 others, mostly fellow students and all experienced hikers and skiers. Each of them held a grade 2 hiking certification and was set to earn the highest level, grade 3, upon completing the grueling 300-kilometer trek. Initially, there were 10 in the group, 8 men and 2 women. As a guide, the group invited 38-year-old Semyon Zolotarev. He was an experienced mountain guide looking to gain an expert ranking on the expedition. But one member, Yuri Yudin, fell ill early in the journey and was forced to turn back. He would be the only one to survive. The rest continued on, following a route designed to take them through the remote northern regions of Svyatogorsk Oblast, with the ultimate goal of reaching Mount Ortin, an ominous peak whose name in the local Manzi language translates to Don't go there. But before we go any further, I'd like to take a moment to talk about each of the victims. The group consisted of Igor Devoltlov, 23. He was the leader. He was meticulous and driven, an experienced hiker with a reputation for keeping expeditions on track. Then there was Yuri Gregory Doshenko, age 21, known for his courage, once facing down a bear with nothing but a geologist's hammer. Ludmila Dubinia, age 20, a tough and disciplined athlete, determined to prove herself in a male-dominated world of extreme trekking. Alexander Kovoltov, 24, a quiet but intelligent student with a background in nuclear physics. Zinata Kolmogorova, age 22. She was described as being so full of energy and always raising everyone's spirits. She was well-liked and had been on previous expeditions with Devoltlov before. Rustem Slobin, age 23. He was athletic, thoughtful, and described as resilient. He had a natural ability to endure the harsh conditions, and he made sure to bring a mandolin with him, which everyone loved that he brought it along, because a little music was a good way for them to entertain themselves on this long journey. Nicolas Thibault, age 23, he was of French descent and was described as charismatic, strong-willed, with a sharp mind for problem-solving. Semyon Zolotarev, the mysterious outsider, age 38, a seasoned hiking instructor and a World War II veteran who had joined the group last minute, replacing another hiker, Yuri Kravinscheko, age 23, who was described as a jokester, musician, and always lightening the mood, but also a skilled outdoorsman. The journey was anticipated to last for 21 days. Starting at Yekaterinburg, they planned to head north, traveling nearly 800 miles using a combination of train, bus, truck, sled, foot, and skis. The group kept a shared journal to detail the events of the trip. They added entries to the diary daily. On January 23rd, 1959, the group met at the train station. They received their official route book. This approved their trek along trail number 5, which was a category 3 route, the most difficult level, made even more treacherous by the brutal February conditions. Noted as one of the most difficult hikes in the USSR, the trip would take them close to the Arctic Circle. The City Committee of Physical Culture and Sport approved their expedition, which was even linked to the 21st Congress of the Communist Party, suggesting it had some official backing. They boarded the train to take them off to the small town of Sarov. January 24th, 1959, at 3 a.m., the others had long since drifted to sleep, their breath rising in soft clouds inside the dimly lit train car. But Zina remained awake, her fingers stiff from the cold as she wrote in the shared diary. Outside, the Siberian night pressed against the windows, an endless void stretching beyond the tracks. She noted that the journey had already been long, but the mandolin helped pass the time, its cheerful notes bringing a brief break from the monotony of travel. But soon, the real adventure would begin. By 7 a.m., the train slowed to a grinding halt as they arrived in Sarov, a remote mining town where visitors were rare and strangers were met with suspicion. This was not the kind of place where outsiders were welcomed with open arms. The locals kept to themselves, heads down, moving quickly through the snow-covered streets. Sarov was not a town for the curious or the uninvited. The moment they stepped off the train, the brutal cold swallowed them whole. The temperature was well below freezing, the kind of cold that gnawed at exposed skin, that made every breath feel like inhaling shards of ice. Desperate for warmth, they tried to wait inside the station, but the officials wouldn't allow it. They would have to endure the cold. As they huddled together, shifting from foot to foot to keep the blood moving, a creeping sense of unease settled over them. They weren't alone. Across the platform, a Soviet policeman stood watching them. He wasn't just glancing in their direction. He was staring. His expression was unreadable, and his gaze unwavering. He never looked away. He didn't blink. He simply watched. The air between them grew heavier with each passing second. The group whispered amongst themselves, trying to shake off the tension, but the officer's presence loomed over them like a storm cloud. Then, as if sensing the need to break the silence, Gregory decided to lighten the mood. He turned towards his friends, clapping his hands together, and broke into a song. A little comic relief, he thought. Something to shake off the weight of that unrelenting stare. But the officer did not find it amusing. The moment the first notes left Gregory's lips, the policeman's face darkened. Without a word, he marched forward, seized Gregory by the arm, and then dragged him away. The group stood frozen. No explanation, no hesitation. Just like that, Gregory was pulled towards the police station, and his protests were swallowed by the howling wind. He was charged with a Section 3 violation, disturbing the peace. A ridiculous charge, but in the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, it was enough to keep him locked up for weeks if the officers so choose. Now, Sarov wasn't just some forgotten mining town. It was surrounded by military bases and secret Soviet prisons. Here, everyone was a suspect. Every outsider, a potential spy. If they didn't get Gregory back, their entire expedition could be over before it even began. Hours passed, and the group waited in the agonizing uncertainty, watching the police station for any signs of their friend. Would he be detained indefinitely? Would he disappear behind those iron doors, never to return? Finally, around noon, Gregory emerged, and he had been given a warning. A reminder to respect Soviet law enforcement. No further punishment, but the message was clear. They were not welcome here. With nowhere to wait until their 6:30 p.m. train, they had to leave the station. Wandering through town, they eventually came across a local school. Zina, ever persuasive, managed to convince the janitor to let them inside under one condition. They had to share their stories with the students. The children gathered eagerly, though one man in the group unsettled them, Semyon Zolotov. To the others, he was just another member of their team. Older, yes, but experienced, strong, and reliable. To these children, however, he was something else entirely. His presence was intimidating. He was a seasoned soldier, a man who had fought on the front lines of World War II. His eyes held the weight of someone who had seen far too much, and his demeanor, hardened, almost unreadable, made him seem different from the rest of the group. The children whispered amongst themselves, hesitant and unsure. But as the group began telling their stories, adventures of hiking, climbing frozen peaks, and surviving the unforgiving wilderness, the children's fear melted into fascination. They leaned in closer, eyes wide, hanging on every word. By the time the group prepared to leave, the children were begging them to stay. But the expedition had to keep schedule, and their journey was just beginning. As they stepped back out into the cold, the eerie tension from earlier was still lingering in the air. They had been watched, and they had been warned. And something told them this was only the first of many strange encounters yet to come. However, they left Sarov, spirits high and ready for the journey ahead, completely unaware that they were walking into one of history's most perplexing unsolved mysteries. They would never return. At midnight, January 25th, the group arrived by train in Avdol, a small town nestled in northern Russia. There was something unsettling about Avdol. The air itself felt tainted, thick with an eerie stillness that pressed down on the skin. It was not just a remote, frozen outpost in the expanses of the Soviet wilderness. It was the hub of a massive gulag prison system. Hundreds of forced labor camps surrounded the town, filled with prisoners of war, political dissidents, and those who had simply disappeared into the machine of the USSR. Men who would never leave. The hikers didn't linger. They didn't want to. From Avdol, they climbed to the back of an old transport truck, packed in tightly like cargo, as it rattled and groaned down the frozen road. The journey was harsh. the road barely more than a scar carved into the snow-covered landscape. They were headed for Vizha, the last inhabited village before the wilderness swallowed the world whole. It was the last place they would ever see other people. On January 27th, the real journey began. The group bundled against the relentless cold, strapping on their skis and pushing forward. Their destination, Gora Ortantan, a lonely, foreboding peak whose name in the language of the local Manzai people meant "don't go there." But before they could truly begin, their group of 10 became 9. By the next morning, January 28th, Yuri Yudin could no longer continue. His body was failing him. The pain in his joints had worsened overnight, his rheumatism flaring, and his heart pounding with exhaustion. He had battled this illness before, but here in the unforgiving landscape, he knew the truth. If he didn't turn back now, he might not make it back at all. The decision was made. Yuri hugged his friends, not knowing that this was the last time he would see them alive. As he turned his back towards Vizha, he had no way of knowing that this would be what saved his life. The rest of the group pressed forward, utterly unaware that they were stepping into one of the greatest mysteries of the 20th century. Gregory, ever the meticulous one, drew a map of their route. He sketched the terrain and noted their positioning, but by 5:30 p.m., the group had reached their limit. They decided to stop for the night, and they made camp along the frozen tracks of the Lozva River. Their tent was a custom design crafted by Igor for this expedition. It was large, built to accommodate 11 people. But now, with Yuri gone, there was extra space. Inside, they had a small stove, a curtain system for privacy, and carefully arranged sleeping order, though this too would soon become a source of tension. Zina, writing in the diary, noted something that seemed trivial at the time. The men were restless, joking and pushing boundaries. Perhaps the cold, the exhaustion, and the isolation were wearing them down. She dismissed it, thinking that if she ignored them, that they might stop. But tension was building. No one wanted to sleep by the stove, placed near the back of the tent where the heat was unpredictable and often suffocating. A decision was made without consulting Gregory. They voted that he was chosen to take the worst spot. Maybe it was the exhaustion, maybe it was the residual bitterness from his earlier run-in with the police in Sarov, but the moment he found out, he snapped. He felt betrayed. Fury simmered in his eyes as he threw himself down by the stove. But he wasn't about to let the others sleep peacefully. Not after this. Throughout the night, he made sure that they didn't forget. He kept having random outbursts and sharp movements and being loud. Sleep was impossible. And the exhaustion, the cold, and the tensions. Something was brewing. And the mountain was waiting. What we know of their journey, we know because of what was found. Diaries, photographs, and a single abandoned tent torn from within. By January 31st, they had reached the highlands. The wind howled through the barren, snow-covered landscape as they set up camp in the wooded valley, a strategic decision. They built a cache of extra food, supplies, and it was a precaution for their return journey. It was a decision based on logic and survival. But they would never return for it. The next morning, they set out again, aiming to cross the pass and descend into the next valley before nightfall. But the weather turned against them. The sky darkened and the snow began to fall. It became thick and blinding, carried by howling winds that screamed through the trees. They pressed on, but unknowingly, they veered off course. Instead of following the planned route, they drifted west towards the slopes of Kohalt Sokol, aka the Mountain of Death. No one thought much of it at the time. Expeditions like these were often unpredictable, and a few extra days in the mountain wouldn't raise any alarms. The terrain had forced them inland and away from their planned route. Now they followed a faint trail used by the Manzai people, the indigenous reindeer herders who had roamed these mountains for centuries. Along the way, the hikers decided to stop and take some photos beside some Manzai signs that were carved into trees. The markers that meant very little to them but carried a deep significance to the people of the land. Some of these signs were simple directions for hunting, warnings about predators, or symbols marking family territories. Others were more cryptic, strange and geometric shapes, and unfamiliar patterns. To the hikers, it was a language they couldn't understand. A diary entry noted their curiosity. The symbols, sometimes crude and worn with age, seemed to appear without warning, scattered along their path like whispered messages from another time. Some of them spoke of wolves, wolverines, elk, moose, lynxes, even the elusive brown bears that stalked the deep forest. And one symbol in particular stood out, a depiction of a creature larger than any man. Its long arms and hunched frame were unmistakable. The Manzai believed that something else lived in these mountains, something older, wilder, something that wasn't supposed to be seen. But the group dismissed it with a laugh. But even they weren't entirely at ease. They were on constant alert. The thought of an animal attack was never far from their minds. By the time they realized their mistake, it was too late. Daylight was fading and the temperature was plummeting. The wind howled across the barren mountainside, a relentless force that gnawed at their exposed skin and filled the air with an eerie, low-pitched moan. The storm was closing in, swallowing the world in an endless sea of white. They had a choice. Just 1.5 kilometers down the dense tree line stood a dark, beckoning sanctuary. Down there, they would find shelter, firewood, and some semblance of protection from the elements. But retreating there meant losing altitude. Altitude they had fought for step by grueling step. So Igor made his decision. They would stay. He believed it was too risky to descend in the worsening conditions, and maybe he wanted to test the group's endurance, pushing them to prove that they could survive a night on the open slope. Or maybe later, as Yuri Yudin speculated, it was a lesson, an exercise in wilderness survival meant to prepare them for even harsher conditions ahead. Whatever the reason, it was here, on this desolate, windswept ridge, that they would spend their final night alive. Igor would send a telegram to the club confirming their safe arrival. The message was expected no later than February 12th. But before parting ways with Yuri Yudin, the Volta had casually mentioned that the trek might take longer than planned. So by February 1st, exhaustion had set in. The hikers were drained, cold, losing steam. Their final entries in the diary reflected the toll of the journey, the relentless cold, the struggle to find firewood, and the gnawing hunger. That night, they didn't even bother digging a fire pit. There wasn't enough wood to keep a fire burning. Instead, they ate inside the tent, a meal shared in eerie silence. Huddled together, their bodies were weary and aching from the journey, and then nothing. The journal ends. The rest of the pages are blank. A sudden stop. No farewell, no final thoughts, and no record of what happened next. Just an empty, silent void where the rest of their story should have been. But there's one last thing. Somewhere in the darkness of that final night, the group took photographs. The recovered film shows something strange. Blurry, distorted images of bright orbs glowing in the night sky. Were they distant stars, or maybe flares? Or was it something else entirely? The images are too unclear to say for certain. And after that, the trail goes cold. Whatever followed during those hours of terror is lost to time. We can only guess what happened to them. But something happened, and they never came back. But when February 12th came and went without a word, there was only mild concern. A few days' delay was nothing unusual, but when a week had passed and still nothing from the hikers, by February 20th, worry had turned to fear. The hikers' families, unable to shake the gnawing sense that something was terribly wrong, they demanded a search party be sent. The Ural Polytechnic Institute responded first, dispatching volunteer students and teachers into the frozen wilderness. Soon after, the army and police joined the effort, sending planes and helicopters to scour the vast snow-covered expanse. Then, on February 26, researchers made their first discovery, a single clue that would only deepen the mystery. The group's tent was found on the Mountain of Death, but something was horribly wrong. The tent was in shambles, half collapsed, and its canvas had been torn open, not from the outside, but from within, as if the hikers had sliced their way out in a desperate panic. Snow had partially buried the campsite, but inside, everything remained eerily undisturbed. Backpacks, clothing, food and shoes, all left behind as if abandoned in an instant. Then came the footprints. Leading away from the tent were 9 distinct set of tracks, trailing down the mountainside towards the dense tree line below. What was chilling wasn't just the fact that the hikers had fled, but how. Some of the prints showed that they were barefoot. Others wore only a sock. A few only had one shoe, as if they had escaped into the deadly cold without any regard for their survival. The trail had stretched nearly a mile before disappearing beneath the snow. At the edge of the forest, beneath a towering Siberian pine, the first bodies were found. Gregory and Yuri lay in the snow, dressed only in their underwear. Their hands and feet were badly frostbitten, and their bodies positioned near a charred remnants of what looked like a small fire. Above them, the lower branches of the tree were snapped, broken as high as 5 meters up. The next 3 bodies were found between the tree and the tent. Igor, Zina, and Rustem. Their bodies lay scattered across the snow, each increasing distances from the fire, as if they had been trying to crawl their way back to the tent. Rustem's skull bore a fracture, though investigators initially assumed he had fallen while stumbling through the darkness. For more than 2 months, the search continued for the remaining 4 hikers. Finally, on May 4th, they were discovered, buried nearly under 13 feet of snow in a ravine that was 75 meters deeper into the woods. Unlike the others, these hikers were better dressed. Their clothing, however, told a grim story. Some garments had clearly been taken from the ones who had died first. Ludmilla, for example. She was found wearing Gregory's burned trousers. Her left foot and shin had been wrapped in a torn jacket in a desperate attempt to keep warm against the merciless cold. But what stunned investigators the most was what happened to these final victims. Their injuries were catastrophic. Rib fractures, shattered skulls, internal trauma so severe that forensic experts later compared it to the force of a car crash. And yet, strangely, there were no external wounds, no cuts, no bruises, and nothing to suggest an impact from a weapon or an animal attack. It was as if an immense, invisible force had crushed them from within. As soon as the first 5 bodies were discovered, a legal inquest was launched. Investigators were desperate for answers, but what they found only deepened the mystery. The medical examination revealed no external injuries severe enough to explain their deaths, just the brutal grip of hypothermia. Rustem had a small fracture in his skull, but it wasn't considered life-threatening. Maybe he had fallen in the chaos, and maybe he had struck his head on the icy terrain. Either way, it wasn't what killed him. Then came the second discovery. 4 more bodies, buried beneath meters of snow, found months later in May. And suddenly, the story took a chilling turn. These hikers hadn't simply frozen to death. They had suffered massive, almost unthinkable injuries. Nicholas Thibault's skull was shattered. Ludmilla and Semyon had sustained extreme chest fractures. According to forensic expert Boris Vorzeny, the force required to cause such injuries was immense, comparable to that of a high-speed car crash. And yet, there was something even more baffling. No external wounds, no bruising, no lacerations, and no sign of a blow. And then there was their faces. The 4 bodies that were found in the ravine had suffered grotesque post-mortem injuries. Zina was missing her tongue, her eyes, and part of her lips. Even a section of her skull bone was gone. Semyon's eyes had vanished, and Alexander Kovaltsov had lost his eyebrows completely. The official forensic report suggested that these injuries had been caused by the running water in the ravine where they were found. But was that really the whole story? Early on, authorities suspected that the indigenous Manzai people, the nomadic reindeer herders native to the area, might have attacked the hikers for trespassing on sacred land. The theory made sense on the surface, and several manzai were questioned, but the evidence told a different story. There was no sign of struggle, no additional footprints, and no defensive wounds, no weapons involved. The hikers had fled from something, and they hadn't fought back. Adding to the strangeness was the state of which their bodies were found. Despite the cold temperatures ranging from negative 25 to negative 30, with a relentless storm raging, many of the hikers were barely dressed. Some wore only socks, and others had just a single shoe. They were wrapped in strips of torn clothing as if the survivors had scavenged from the dead in a desperate attempt to stay warm. What had driven them to flee into the deadly cold? Why had they abandoned their tent, their gear, and their protection? And what kind of force had caused catastrophic injuries without leaving a mark on their skin? The more investigators uncovered, the less sense it all made. Much of the fascination and the obsession with the Dvoltov Pass incident comes from the inexplicable condition of the hikers' remains. The scene was something out of a nightmare, each discovery more unsettling than the last. Over the decades, theories have run rampant, each one more wilder than the next. An infrasound-induced hysteria, an animal attack, a sudden avalanche, a deadly katabatic wind, some whisper of Yetis, while others murmur about secret KGB operations, CIA interference, and even nuclear weapon testing. A few claim the sky itself had betrayed them, that something fell from above, something the government didn't want the world to know about. Then there were the bodies. Alexander had burns on his skin, not frostbite, but burns. And when the medical examiner took a closer look, they found something even stranger. A piece of flesh was inside his mouth, flesh that he had bitten off of his own hand. What had driven him to do that? Five bodies had been found, their deaths attributed to hypothermia. This wasn't unusual, and not in the deadly cold of the Ural Mountains. In extreme cases, hypothermia can trigger something that's called paradoxical undressing, a cruel trick played on the dying brain, making a freezing person feel as if they're burning up. This could explain why some of the hikers were found with nothing more than their undergarments, and their fate would only deepen the mystery. Some of the locals in the Soviet Union began to murmur that something wasn't right. Whispers of a cover-up spread through the populace like a wildfire. And then the discovery came. Some of the hikers' clothes contained traces of radiation. Had the hikers stumbled into a weapons test? Had they been caught in fallout of a classified experiment? The government, of course, denied everything. Journalists gained access to portions of the inquest file, revealed several chilling details from the report. Six of the hikers had died from hypothermia, and three had suffered fatal injuries. No traces of other people, not the attackers, not the rescuers, were found anywhere near the site. The only footprints found belonged to the nine hikers themselves. The tent had been slashed open from the inside, and whatever had sent them fleeing, they had been desperate to escape it. They had died 6 to 8 hours after their last meal, and every single one of them had left the campsite voluntarily on foot. And then there was the radiation. Not much, but enough to raise eyebrows. Enough to make people wonder what exactly happened on the frozen mountainside. As for the idea of the indigenous Manzai people to attack the group, forensic expert Boris Vorzideni dismissed it outright. The damage to the bodies was too severe. No human could have inflicted such force. Something else had been responsible, but what? The documents contained no details about the hikers' internal organs. The records, the files, and the explanations all felt incomplete, as though something had deliberately been left out. From the time the final bodies were autopsied on May 9, 1959, only 19 days had passed when the Russian government decided to close the case. When the official investigation concluded, the verdict was vague and it was unsettling. The hikers had died to, quote, a compelling natural force. But what force? No one could or would say. The case was closed. The files were then locked away in a secret archive. And the questions, the speculation, and the fear, those would never go away. One of the most chilling theories surrounding the Develtov Pass incident suggests that the hikers weren't alone on the frozen mountainside, that something massive, something inhuman was out there with them. This idea gained traction when investigators found a cryptic note inside of the abandoned tent. Scrawled on a piece of paper were the words, "From now on, we know that snowmen exist." Snowmen. It was an odd phrase, but whatever its intended meaning, it fueled speculation that a Yeti had been responsible for their deaths. There was no sign of large footprints at the site, but there was a photograph, a single frame captured on one of the victims' cameras. You can see a blurred, shadowed, but undeniably strange, towering, dark figure standing amongst the trees, sort of hunched over. To some, it was just an overexposed shot. Others, it was something far more sinister. And to some, it was very squatchy. But what exactly is a Yeti, and how does it compare to its more famous counterpart of Bigfoot? The Yeti, which is sometimes also called the Abominable Snowman, it has been a part of Himalayan folklore for centuries, long before Western explorers set their foot in the region. Unlike Sasquatch, who is often associated with dense forest and temperate climates, the Yeti is a creature of ice and snow, surviving in the most inhospitable places on Earth. Descriptions vary, but it is often described as a muscular, shaggy-furred being larger than a man and with strength beyond anything known. Unlike Bigfoot, which is often described as elusive and reclusive, the Yeti carries a reputation for aggression. Some of the indigenous Himalayan tribes even worshipped it and called it the glacier being. Ancient cultures spoke of the Yeti as a real and dangerous force. The Lhecha people revered a towering glacier giant, while the Tibetan and Nepal monasteries claimed to possess relics, bones, skulls, and even scalps that were believed to belong to these creatures. Some of these artifacts made their way to the Smithsonian Museum, where the modern science examined them. While one specimen was confirmed to be human, others remain unidentified to this day. Sightings of the Yeti stretch back thousands of years from the 6th century BC all the way to modern times. One of the earliest Western accounts dates back to 1832, when B.H. Hodgson, a trekker in northern Nepal, reported seeing a large, bipedal creature covered in dark hair. His local guides were terrified, and to them, it wasn't an animal. It was a living creature in the traditional sense. They called it a Kakoa demon, which translates to a demon of the mountains. They fled before they could get a better look. Even Sir Edmund Hillary, the first man to stand atop of Mount Everest, couldn't resist the mystery. A skilled mountaineer, war pilot, and later New Zealand's ambassador to India, he was also known, in a way, as a cryptozoologist. The call of the unknown pulled him into the search for the Yeti in the 1950s. The stories of strange footprints and eerie encounters became impossible to ignore. Hillary himself found Yeti tracks while trekking through the Burn Run Kola Range in 1953. His team discovered more in the Chaigon Valley later that year. And then there were the Sherpas, the people who had lived in the shadow of these mountains for generations. Many of them sworn they had seen the creature with their own eyes. And to them, the Yeti was no myth. It was real, and it was dangerous. But what does any of this have to do with Develtov Pass? In 2014, the Discovery Channel aired The Russian Yeti, The Killer Lives, a documentary that explored the theory that the hikers were killed by a Yeti. The show pointed to the gruesome wounds on the bodies, injuries too severe to be caused by humans, the broken ribs and the crushed skulls, with no defensive wounds and no sign of a struggle, as if something had struck them with an unimaginable force, something far stronger than any man. So, could a Yeti have been responsible? If so, why weren't there any tracks? Did the howling wind erase them before investigators arrived? What about the cryptic note? "From now on, we know snowmen exist." Was the note written in jest? Or had they seen something truly lurking in the night? But the Yeti attack still does not explain the radioactive material that was found on the victims. It is impossible to say just how much nuclear radiation that the hikers were exposed to before their deaths. Some of their bodies had been found partially submerged in a stream. Running water can wash away radioactive particles. And yet, even 15 days later, after being battered by the icy stream, their clothes still tested positive for levels of radiation far beyond what was normal. In fact, their garments contained more radioactive material than what you would expect to see from scientists working directly with nuclear substances, even those involved with the construction of atomic bombs. Something had hit them with an enormous dose of radiation. But where did it come from? One theory is a little bizarre, but not entirely impossible. It suggests that the source was not man-made at all. Could it be the Yeti emits radiation? It sounds absurd, but consider this. If such a creature has evaded science for this long, might it possess biological traits unlike anything we've ever encountered? Could its very presence and its unique makeup, its adaptation to the extreme wilderness, somehow generate or store radiation? It's a strange thought, and without a Yeti to examine, we cannot prove or disprove it. But if the Yeti theory fails to fully explain the radiation, then perhaps we must look beyond this world. UFOs. They have fascinated and terrified us for decades. Blazing lights in the sky, sudden abductions, and inexplicable encounters. On the very night the hikers died, multiple witnesses in the area reported seeing something extraordinary. Glowing, pulsating orbs of light that danced across the sky and moving in unnatural precision. The last photographs ever taken by the group seem to corroborate these accounts. Images show a strange, luminous presence above them in the mountains. Even the local Manzai people spoke of these lights, but to them they were a bad omen, a sign of something dark approaching. And they were right. Something terrible did happen that night. Why would a UFO target 9 hikers? If we accept that they were confronted by something not of this earth, then what happened next could follow one of two patterns, and both are consistent with other alleged alien encounters. Perhaps mind control had taken hold of the hikers, an invisible, overpowering force compelling them to abandon all reason and step out of their tent into the deadly cold, half-dressed, without boots or coats. And perhaps it was something much more primal, pure, unrelenting, terror. Did the hikers see something that they weren't meant to see? Did they flee in panic, trying to escape an unknown force? And if so, was this some kind of experiment? Because if extraterrestrial intelligence was involved, that might also explain the radiation. Several UFO researchers have speculated that alien craft might be powered by nuclear energy. If the hikers had come too close to such a craft, they could have been exposed to deadly levels of radiation. If they had been taken, abducted, even briefly, their bodies could have absorbed cosmic radiation before returning. And there's something else. The area surrounding the campsite bore another unsettling clue. Lev, the lead investigator on the case, reported a strange anomaly. The pine trees near the campsite were scorched at their tops as though something had passed over them, searing them from above. But when the official report was released, that detail was missing. Or should I say, omitted. Lev later admitted that a Soviet official named A.P. Korolenko had pressured him to remove any mention of UFOs or unexplained phenomena from the case files. The question here is why? What had the Soviet government wanted to bury? What truth lay beneath the snow in that lonely, windswept pass where 9 hikers met a fate more chilling than the cold itself? Because whatever happened that night, something or someone did not want us to know. And UFOs were not the only possible explanation for the scorched treetops near the Devoltov Pass incident. Another phenomena, one just as mysterious and deadly, could be responsible. Ball lightning. A rare and little understood weather occurrence where ball lightning has long been studied and a subject of speculation. Witnesses describe it as an orb of glowing electric energy ranging in color from an eerie blue to a searing orange, sometimes even yellow. It moves unpredictably, floating and hovering and sometimes zipping through the air before vanishing in an instant. According to National Geographic, ball lightning is commonly observed during thunderstorms, but its exact nature remains elusive. Some believe it's plasma, and others believe it's an electromagnetic phenomena. Could this explain the strange orbs that the hikers and independent witnesses claim to have seen that night? The presence of ball lightning might also provide an answer to another lingering mystery: the high levels of radiation that were found on some of the victims' clothing. While radiation and ball lightning are not directly connected in mainstream scientific studies, there have been some anecdotal accounts suggesting an interaction between electromagnetic anomalies and radiation hotspots. And yet, despite these strange possibilities, one thing remains clear. The hikers did not die in an avalanche. The location of their camp showed no signs of a catastrophic snowslide. An avalanche would have left telltale signs: massive debris fields, broken tree limbs, and buried bodies under thick layers of snow. But when the searchers arrived, they found something different altogether. The first set of bodies, those discovered within a month of the tragedy, were only lightly covered by snow, their forms still visible beneath the thin, frozen layers. If an avalanche had swept through with enough force to drag other members of the group deep into the forest, it would have done the same to them, and yet they remained in place. The second group of bodies, found deeper in the woods 2 months later, displayed injuries that are inconsistent with an avalanche: broken ribs, crushed skulls, and massive trauma. Yet, with little external damage, as though some immense force had struck them from within. Over 100 expeditions have been conducted in the Devoltov Pass region since this tragedy. Not one has reported conditions conducive to an avalanche. Studies of the terrain using modern physics have reinforced the same conclusion. The slope where the hikers camped was not steep enough to trigger such an event. This so-called dangerous condition that some researchers pointed to were only present in a separate area, one with far steeper inclines and an entirely different snowfall pattern. And those dangerous conditions were observed in April and May, long after the deep freezes of February, when the Devolto group met their end. Even if, against all odds, an avalanche had occurred, its trajectory would have bypassed the tent entirely. The damage to the tent collapsed from the sides rather than being buried underneath 4 tons of snow. It tells a different story. So what made the hikers leave the tent? A re-examination of the case in 2015 by Russian investigators proposed a new theory. The hikers triggered a slab avalanche when they dug into the snow to set up camp. According to this hypothesis, a slow-moving shift in the snowfall could have gradually pressed down on the tent, leading them to believe an avalanche was imminent. In their panic, they slashed their way out and retreated into the night, seeking shelter in the forest. Some froze to death near a hastily built fire, and others succumbed while trying to return to camp, and the final 4 may have fallen into a snow-filled ravine, suffering injuries on impact. Some researchers in 2019 have suggested that a rare phenomena called katabatic wind, a sudden, violent downdraft, could have forced the hikers from their tent. Katabatic winds have been responsible for other mountaineering disasters, including a 1978 tragedy in Sweden that claimed the lives of 8 hikers. Such winds can arrive at a terrifying speed, carrying hurricane-force gusts and making it impossible to remain in place. The theory suggests that the hikers faced the oncoming storm and abandoned their tent to seek shelter behind the tree line. For every question answered, a dozen more remain. At the height of the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union were locked in a relentless battle for dominance, racing to perfect long-range missiles and expand their nuclear arsenals. These experiments were conducted in the deepest of secrecy, often in remote, desolate regions where prying eyes or foreign spies would be unlikely to stumble upon something classified. But what if, one winter night in 1959, 9 hikers found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time, and what their camera captured was something they were not meant to see? Streaks of light cutting through the sky, a secret Soviet experimental weapon. To the Soviet military, this was not a group of wayward students on an innocent adventure. They were, in a classified zone, potential leaks of sensitive information that could not be allowed to escape. Silencing them could have been not only merely necessary, it was a warning. What followed was not just a killing, it was a brutal and methodical punishment, and some of the hikers were mutilated beyond recognition. One theory suggests that the hikers camped within a blast radius, and that they were startled awake by the deafening explosions, and that is why they fled their tent in terror, shoeless and unprotected against the brutal cold. The bombs could have detonated in air, sending shockwaves through the valley. Soviet records confirm that parachute mines were being tested around the region around the time of the hikers' disappearance. The mine's unique detonation pattern caused precisely the kind of injuries that would have been seen on the bodies. Massive internal trauma with minimal outward damage. And then there were the strange orbs, glowing, floating anomalies reported by locals and photographed by the hikers. Another theory delves deeper into the enigma of radiation. Some of the hikers' clothing bore traces of radioactive contamination. Their skin and hair exhibited strange discoloration. Radiation exposure could explain much of the hikers' injuries. Some theories believe that the answer lies in directed energy weaponry. Nikola Tesla once claimed to have invented an electrical death ray, capable of unleashing beams of energy with lethal precision. In 1937, he vowed to demonstrate his power. But before he could, he was struck by a car and he died soon after. Did his ideas survive him, falling into the hands of the world's most secretive military programs? If such a weapon existed, the Soviet Union would have been desperate to develop it. Investigators found signs of burning at the treetops, though no logical source of fire could be identified. Decades later, the original investigator admitted that he had been ordered to keep certain details quiet. He spoke of heated beams of strong, unknown energy, beams that seemed to target specific objects and leaving no epicenter of destruction, a prototype weapon tested in the frozen expanse of the Urals. If so, the hikers may have been the first civilian casualty of such an experiment. Yet, even this theory leaves questions unanswered. Why did only some of the hikers exhibit radiation while others did not? And why did they abandon their tent in such a state of panic, as if fleeing from an invisible force? After years passed, hidden documents began to surface. A chilling discovery revealed that a Soviet prosecutor's office opened the case on the group's death 3 weeks before the campsite was ever discovered. 11 days before their tent was found, a letter surfaced, a document verifying that the officials knew of the hikers' death long before the search team arrived. But how could they have known unless they had been involved? Official Soviet records claim no military presence in the region at the time, but it seems that the Soviet government has never been eager to solve the mystery. In 2019, Russian authorities reopened the case only to announce that they would consider weather-related explanations alone. No discussion of military experiments, no consideration of radiation exposure, and no mention of unexplained injuries. Perhaps the hikers were simply victims of nature's wrath. Perhaps an avalanche or katabatic winds drove them from their tent, but the strange injuries, the secrecy, the missing evidence, and the lingering radiation all whisper of a truth far darker. If the hikers were indeed casualties of an unknown experiment, then the answers lied buried beneath decades of Cold War secrecy, frozen in the same snow where 9 young adventurers met a fate more horrifying than any storm. The hikers left their tent willingly, that much is clear. But what force, natural or unnatural, compelled them to do so? Was it an avalanche that never came? A windstorm that tore through the pass with a supernatural violence? A rare, crackling ball of lightning drifting too close for comfort? Or did they see something in the sky? Something watching them that made them calmly walk into the frozen abyss? The Devoltov Pass remains as silent as it was on that fateful night in 1959. But somewhere, beneath the ice and the secrecy, the truth awaits. And maybe, just maybe, it is watching. that is the story of the Voltov Pass incident, a case that even after decades refuses to give up its secrets. Whatever happened that night, one thing is certain. Something beyond our understanding took place on that frozen mountainside. Thank you so much for joining me on this journey into the unknown. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting Dark Florida and leave a 5-star review wherever you listen. It really does help the show. And you can give us a follow on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast, and feel free to email me directly at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com with your own strange encounters. You can also support the show at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida to help keep the show going. And remember, mysteries like these don't stay buried forever. Eventually, the truth has a way of clawing its way to the surface. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.